Good evening. I hope that you have your Bibles. I would encourage you to turn in the book of 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3 is the passage that we're going to be studying tonight. I am so glad that you're here. I know that you probably have had a very busy day with work, or maybe not so much work, maybe just running around, getting errands done. We are certainly glad that you've taken time to be here and to study together this evening. A lot of friends that I've grown to love over the years with us tonight. And I appreciate the extra effort that you've taken to be here. And I appreciate the members that are here. After four lessons of me yesterday, that is like slack overload right there. So I really do appreciate you being here and being out tonight. We started out yesterday morning by saying that that working on your marriage is sort of like a remodeling project. And having just completed your project here recently, you, I'm sure, have some firsthand experience with that, that it takes longer than you originally planned, that it costs you more than what you previously calculated, that it was a whole lot messier than you ever could have imagined, and it required a lot more determination to finish the task than you had ever expected. And there's a comparison to that when you begin working on a marriage, and because of those things being true, there are a lot of husbands and wives who go out in search of some shortcuts, some ways that they think will achieve ultimately the same end. Just like you're tempted to do in a remodeling project, you may find yourself skimping on important facets of the construction or look for shortcuts that you think are going to be just a little bit cheaper, a little bit more convenient, a little easier to accomplish. And so you buy less costly materials, which are, in reality, inferior materials. We live in a day of synthetics, don't we? Imitations and counterfeits and artificials. Leather is never going to be replaced by vinyl, but there's a whole lot of vinyl out there in the world, isn't there? Laminates are replacing real wood. Artificial flowers bloom all year long and they don't need a drop of water to do it. Today, the phony can look so real that it's easy to be fooled. And who among us has not reached out in a restaurant or something to feel that surely can't, that has to be a real flower, and then you find out that it's silk. We've come to the point where we're content with cheaper imitations because we don't want to pay the price to have the real thing. Now that's fine when you're talking about, you know, buying margarine instead of butter, or you know, some particle wood furniture instead of solid wood furniture. But it's a totally different thing when you're talking about a relationship. When God's blueprint, is that me, Don?
I don't know.
Testing. Nothing? Okay, all right. Time out, time in. Where was I? Oh, yes. When God's blueprint is ignored, when the foundation is not poured correctly, when second-rate materials are used, it ought to come as no surprise to us that marriage fails to pass the test of time. The good news, however, is that a marriage can be rebuilt, though it can sometimes be costly. Changes can be implemented, renovation can transpire, and a beautiful structure be the result. But understand that that doesn't happen by accident. Things just don't automatically fall into place. It'll require a great deal of effort to cultivate the proper spirit and a teachable heart, and to have a positive and committed attitude, and most of all, to come to a point where we are willing to set self aside. We come to the point in our studies tonight where we're going to begin putting bricks, if you will, on our structure. We began with the foundation. We then, by looking at the different roles, the husband and the wife, we put a framework, if you will, on that foundation. And tonight what I want us to do is to add bricks, if you will, to the walls of that structure. In physical construction, bricks obviously provide a number of different elements. They provide strength and durability, insulation, and certainly beauty. And the bricks that are listed for us here in 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 1 through 7, provide those very same things. to a marriage. But just like in construction, you can choose an inferior, a cheaper material that you think will accomplish the same thing, but it will not. Now, before we get to 1 Peter chapter 3, it's important for us to step back a little bit and look in chapter 2 and review the context in which this instruction to husbands and wives is found. And the passage on marriage is actually set within a passage in which the apostle is challenging his readers to respond correctly even in the midst of unfair circumstances. So in chapter 3, verses 13 through 17, it's how citizens deal with unfair governments. In verse 18 through 20, how slaves deal with unfair masters. And then he points in verses 21 through 25 of the example of Christ and how he dealt with his unfair accusers. And then you'll notice he moves into chapter 3 in verses 1 through 6, in which he talks about wives dealing with unfair husbands. And into the fabric of these seven verses, chapter 3, verses 1 through 7, we're going to look tonight at three bricks for wives and three bricks for husbands. But we're also going to reference the fact that there are some substitutes that can be put in place. They're cheaper, they're inferior, and they will not accomplish what Peter says the actual bricks will. Let's read along, if you would. 1 Peter chapter 3. And let's begin our look at verse 1. Peter writes, "In the same way, you wives, being submissive to your own husbands, so that if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives as they observe your chaste and respectful behavior. Your adornment must not be merely external, braiding the hair and wearing gold jewelry and putting on dresses, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. For in this way, in former times, the holy women also, who hoped in God, used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their own husbands, just as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you have become her children if you do what is right without being frightened by any fear. You husbands, in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way, as with someone weaker, since she is a woman, and show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life, so that your prayers will not be hindered." Now, before we get to the text itself, I want you to notice that chapter 3 and verse 1 begins with the phrase, "in the same way." And what he's pointing back to is the example of Jesus Christ, who we understand is the whole pattern of Christian conduct. It's not just wives, but it's also husbands are to follow the example of Jesus in their relationships in life. If you skip down to verse 7, you'll notice there, "you husbands in the same way." In other words, just like Jesus, neither the husband nor the wife is to be concerned about their rights. Instead, they are to behave as God would have them to, and then allow the righteous judge to be the one who sees and rewards. It's important because the tendency of many husbands and wives is for us to view our responsibilities in marriage as conditional, and conditional in such a way as to be directly hinged to the behavior of their mates. In other words, a wife will say, "I'll start being the wife that I need to be when my husband starts being the husband that he ought to be." Or the husband will say, "I'll be the husband that I need to be when my wife starts being the wife that she ought to be." And when you start down that path, what you begin is this increasingly downward spiral. And what Peter says is that whole approach is not the attitude of Jesus. And so he calls upon both husbands and wives to follow the example of Jesus, to follow the will of God, and allow the righteous judge to see and to reward. Beginning here in chapter 3 and verse 1, he says, "You wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives as they observe your chaste and respectful behavior." The first brick that I want us to notice tonight is the brick of visible conduct. Visible conduct. Though this woman would certainly, one situation is where she would be married to an unbeliever, I don't think it's exclusive to unbelievers. It's a husband who's disobedient to the word. I think that could include an unbeliever or a believer. The issue is he's not obeying the will of God. And as a result of that, he's a man who may be very difficult for her to live with. But what Peter goes on to say is that while that fellow may be irritating, while he may be a little bit frustrating and rather annoying, he's not blind. And so he calls upon the wife to influence her husband by his observation of her chaste, and notice the word here, respectful behavior. Ladies, we talked about that yesterday morning, the importance of respecting our husband and how important that is to a man to be respected by his wife. The word observe there, it doesn't describe a casual glance, but instead a very careful look, a studious glare, if you will. It is a look that's fully absorbed in what it sees. It has our full attention and focus. And what Peter says is that this woman is not so much to preach her Christianity to her husband as she is instructed to practice it in front of him. That it's not so much with her mouth, but rather with the example of her life that she demonstrates to her husband the sincerity of her claims. A number of years ago, I was traveling with another fellow. We were over in China, and we were studying with this young lady, and I've watched this young lady just grow and mature over the years. When I first started going, she wasn't a Christian. She came to one of the studies, and the next trip I went back, she'd become a Christian. And then another trip, she had a boyfriend, but he wasn't a Christian. And then I went back, and she was married to this young man, and he still wasn't a Christian. And as she talked to us about how desperately she wanted him to become a believer, it became very clear to my friend and I that basically what she was trying to do was nag him into the kingdom. She just thought if she annoyed him enough, that he would eventually surrender. And we opened up her Bible to this passage, and we asked her to read the first two verses. And as she looked up from the page of the Bible, there were tears coming down her cheeks. And she looked at both of us, and she said, "But that's so." And because it's hard, a lot of wives are tempted to substitute something, to apply another brick that they believe is going to be equally effective. Because in her mind, her husband's not going to change unless she says or does something. And so what wives substitute is manipulation. They think they've got a better plan than God does. They believe that chaste and respectful behavior is too easily ignored, too quickly taken advantage of. And so through mood changes and nagging and pouting, through sulking and scheming and bargaining and coercing, by using humiliation and deceit and sex as weapons, she seeks to change her husband by coercing and manipulating him into what she wants him to become. Ladies, understand that the truth is that your husband cannot be manipulated into making any real and permanent changes in who he is. Peter tells us, ladies, you are responsible for you, not your husband. And if you choose this particular substitute, I assure you, you will do far more damage to your relationship than you could ever imagine. By the way, let me just add this note. Her husband became a Christian and is one of the leaders there in that particular city. They have gone on, they've had a little girl, and it's just the little girl's now about 10 years old and just very strong spiritually. And what an encouragement to be around her and her husband a couple of years ago. Now, let's talk practical here. What are we talking about when we talk about a wife whose behavior is chaste and respectful? What kind of woman does Peter have in mind? He has in mind a woman who's not involved in making cutting remarks to her husband or about her husband to other people. She's not looking to continually remind him, we would say nag, you know, about his faults or his mistakes or his failings. She's not going to be looking to publicly demean him, but instead she's going to be trustworthy and dependable. She's going to be satisfied with her position and her possessions and her responsibilities. When she gives advice or suggestions or her opinions, she looks to state them tactfully and lovingly. She looks to express her appreciation for the things that he does for her and demonstrates, as we mentioned yesterday, a confidence in the decisions that she makes. Now, ladies, I understand that your husband doesn't get everything right. But you need to understand that the man that you're married to would die for you in an instant. I was counseling a couple, actually. It was premarital counseling, but they'd been married 3 years. They just came to me and they said, "We've never been through it. We've heard about it. We'd like to go through it." I can do that. And we came to this part, and I asked the young man who was sitting there, and I said, would you be willing to die for her?" "Absolutely." I asked her the same question. She goes, "Well, I guess. We've talked about the fact that guys and girls are different. That's just one of them. That's just one of them. And I mean, I think she would. She wasn't hesitating because, you know, she's wondering, you know, that doesn't sound like a good deal to me." There's something built into a man that has a sense of honor in that way. That's why men, I think, make better soldiers. Because it's built, we're hardwired that way. Ladies, your husband would die for you. He doesn't get everything right. He has his flaws. He makes his share of mistakes. But understand how deeply he loves you, whether he shows it demonstrably or not. We'll get to him in a minute on that point. You'll notice the second brick here, and that's in verses 3 and 4. It's internal attitude. The internal attitude, Peter says, "Your adornment must not be merely external, braiding the hair and wearing gold jewelry or putting on dresses, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God." Now, what Peter's talking about here is not a prohibition, but a priority. He's not bad-mouthing cosmetics or jewelry or nice clothing. What he is encouraging is balance. Especially in our culture, women are bombarded through a variety of mediums that how you look physically is what really matters. And young ladies especially, Satan's lie is that the way you dress, the way you look physically, is the primary way of trying to attract the eye of a young man. More so than who you are as a person. Let me assure you, if you go looking for a fella on that kind of a basis, don't be surprised if the guy that you catch and the guy that you really would have liked to be married to are two very different individuals. Peter says, you place the focus on the inside. Now, understand, a woman who takes care of her external appearance is a lady who has a lot of respect for herself. I'm not suggesting that you go around looking like an unmade bed all the time, and neither is Peter. But what Peter is doing is he's drawing our attention to the outside to show us the priority that ought to be on the inside. You can go to the mall and you can buy all kinds of coordinating outfits, right? We talked about that yesterday. You can buy all kinds of coordinating outfits. You can get your hair done up. You can get some jewelry. It's not going to make you any more beautiful in the way that Peter's talking about here. Because those kinds of things are not a substitute for the internal makeup of a godly woman. What matters to the Lord is your character, who you are as an individual. And you'll notice that Peter describes that person here in verse 4 as someone who possesses a quiet and gentle spirit. Now, some of you ladies might be thinking to yourself right now, "You know what, Terry, you already lost me because I'm not that kind of woman." Because you think that what Peter has in mind here is a woman who's weak or a woman who's timid. That's not what he's describing here. Gentle speaks of an absence of struggle or contention. You're not fighting against God, or you're not fighting against others. You're not fighting against your husband. There's no signs of rebellion or resentment. You're respectful and trustworthy. quiet indicates a tranquility that comes from within. There's no disturbance to others. In other words, this lady, she's not a doormat for anybody. These are terms that speak of strength and dignity and self-control. You remember in Proverbs chapter 31, we find there a woman, a wife, who is described as rare and capable, that she's worthy of her husband's trust, that she has respect in the eyes of others. And the writer says of her that she is an excellent wife. And then there is this line that I just love from Proverbs 31. Strength and dignity are her clothing. This is the woman of who has a strength of character, a dignity of person. There's a confident class about her. That's not weakness. That's not timidity. Externals can be thrown on in a matter of minutes. Cultivating this kind of an attitude will take you an entire lifetime. And you'll notice that Peter says that this kind of spirit is perceived by God as an imperishable quality that's precious in His sight. It's imperishable, that is, it's free from decay or theft, things to which all of those external things are prone to. Sooner or later, we're all going to decay, aren't we? The hair is going to turn gray unless you're a L'Oreal lady. The skin's going to begin to wrinkle. The body's going to begin to sag and slump. I think it was Irma Bombeck who said, you know, I have the same things that I had 25 years ago. They're just all 4 inches lower. When you focus your attention on internal beauty, Peter says you're putting an effort into something that's immune to the passing of time. Wives, your attitude is viewed by God as that important. Its influence cannot be underestimated or erased or passed over or destroyed. Now, the substitute here is obvious, isn't it? We've already kind of focused on it. And that is, you just substitute external appearance. And women make that swap all of the time in our day. They trade the internal for the external. But understand that externals will never be as important in the sight of God, and they will never be as effective in your marriage as working on the person that you are on the inside. Ladies, our society is going to place a lot of pressure on you to substitute a perfect body, attractive clothing, expensive jewelry, exquisite accessories for a character of quality that exists within. Do not buy what Satan is selling, please. Proverbs 31, verse 30. Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Brick number 3. Attention to her husband's good. Look at verses 5 and 6. He says, "For in this way, in former times, the holy women also, who hoped in God, used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their own husbands. Just as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you have become her children if you do what is right, without being frightened by any fear." When it says that Sarah obeyed, she paid close attention to Abraham. And it reveals volumes, really, about her relationship. We don't have time tonight to go into detail on these two verses. Let me just summarize that what Peter's saying here is that she was respectful of him, that she was attentive to his needs, that she cooperated with his wishes. And when we look back in Genesis chapter 2 and verses 18 through 22, what we find there is that the primary role of the wife, you remember, was to be a helper who corresponded to her husband. She was there to provide good for her husband. And that was where Sarah set her priority. She wasn't out doing things that were detrimental or harmful to him. She didn't participate in things that would cause her to neglect the primary ministry that she had of being a helper suitable for her husband. And ladies, I think sometimes there is a tendency on women's parts to get distracted by all kinds of things, to respond to all kinds of needs, that it depletes most, if not all, of the energy, time, and attention that you have. And as a result, you become more concerned with things and people outside of your home rather than the one person who God says is to be the most important person in your life who lives in your home. The inferior substitute here is found in the middle of the passage, and that is that you begin to think that you know what to do, but you fail to do it. At least I know the right thing to do. Peter says, you will become her children if you do what is right. whether it's a husband or a wife, it's the things that we've been talking about this weekend and this week. It's not a situation that we don't know what to do. The problem is we don't do what we know. I'm not telling you anything new. You know all of these things. We just don't do them. We may see, we may recognize that some things need to change, but it's not enough just for us to say, you know, I ought to be doing better in some areas of my marriage. That's not enough. We have to take that evaluation a step further. We have to not only see and recognize, but we have to take meaningful steps to do something about it. James 1, verses 22 through 25. Not just hearing the word, but being a doer of the word. Ladies, evaluate your goals. Examine your priorities. Consider the importance of your role. Take an honest look at your part in the marriage. And then refuse to substitute assessments for application of what Peter says here. Well, I guess our time's gone. We'll just skip over husbands tonight. No. No. You don't get off that easy. How bad can one verse be, right, guys? I know some of you ladies are thinking, you know, it just doesn't seem fair. I got six and he's got one passage. But let me assure you, ladies, that what Peter packs into this one verse is like dynamite. There's a lot of power that's here. Verse 7, he says, "You husbands, in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way as with someone weaker, since she is a woman, and show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life, so that your prayers will not be hindered." You guys ready for a softball? Live with your wife. Now, some of you are thinking already, I got this one down. I got this. You know, we have the same address. We live in the same house. Eat at the same table. Sleep in the same bed. That's not what Peter has in mind. The term here carries the idea of dwelling down with. It's being at home with someone. What Peter's calling for here is a close companionship, a deep abiding togetherness. A cultivation of an in-depth partnership with your mate. And obviously what we want to substitute here, guys, is just our physical presence. We're there. Now, we may have ESPN on, you know, we may be watching SportsCenter, but hey, at least I'm there. You're present, but you're not present. When I lived in Indiana, I got into IU basketball big time. And so, Bev, she would stand in front of the television set during a game if she wanted to talk to me. And even then, I'm not sure I listened exactly. I heard what she was saying. I just wasn't listening to her very well. I was there, but I wasn't there. Peter says you be there. Now, the success at your living with your wife is directly proportional to the next piece of instruction, and that is to know your wife. Peter says, live with your wives in an understanding way. Literally, dwell together according to knowledge. If you are going to be at home with your wife, then it's dependent upon your accurate and ongoing understanding of who she is. Now, gentlemen, God does not mock us. What He says here can be done, but it doesn't happen by accident. It's not automatic. It requires that we engage our minds and invoke our wills to put into use that spherical object that rests upon our shoulders. Gentlemen, whether we like it or not, it is our responsibility to take the risk and to put forth the initiative to be engaged in a studious investigation of the one woman to whom we're married. Understand, God is not saying you have to understand what women want. You just have to understand what one woman. And that's the one that you're married to. The word understanding, let me illustrate it here. You think about something and you study something and you look at it from one angle and you look at it from another angle. And after a few moments of investigation and study, the wires suddenly connect and a light bulb comes on and you say, that's how it works. That's understanding. And to pull this off in regard to our wives, it involves the skill of discernment and reason judgment. To put it in terms we can, I think, all understand, we need to learn to speak the language of Our Lady. Men and women speak very different languages. When a woman says, "I have nothing to wear," what she means is, "I have nothing new to wear." When a man says, "I have nothing to wear," what he means is, "I have nothing clean to wear." When you learn a foreign language, it requires effort and study. You don't just pick up a foreign language in a matter of a couple of hours. It requires tremendous diligence and perseverance. And it especially requires that you listen very, very well. I speak just a few words in Chinese. I took lessons for a while, but I kind of forget. I don't use it a lot. And so I tend to forget everything because I'm not using it. And therefore, when I hear it, I don't pick up the words that I at one time used to know. We talked yesterday about some of the things that she needs, that she needs demonstrated affection. We talked about, writing a note, sending it to her in the mail. We talked about, helping around the house. We talked about it, evening out. We talked about taking her shopping someplace besides, Sports Authority and Home Depot. Just spending time with her. Or planning a weekend away and you doing all the planning and surprising her. Or bringing her flowers. Now, Your Lady, maybe flowers aren't her deal. Maybe chocolate is. Whatever her need is. And by the way, here, fellas, ladies, tune me out right now, okay? I can't listen to anything that I've got to say. I've got a secret I need to pass on to the guys here, okay? Tune me out. All right, here we go. Guys, here's the secret in regard to flowers. You don't have to drop $75 on a dozen roses. What I do is I look in Kroger's ad or Albertson's ad. I don't think you have Albertson's now here, but, or Tom Thumb, I think it's Randall's down here. And you keep an eye out. And especially like in the summertime, I can go by and I can get a bundle of gladiolas for $2.99. We all waste $3 on junk through the course of a week. And if you do that more often, you don't have to throw down the $125 at Valentine's Day because you feel guilty because you hadn't bought her flowers any other time during the year. You realize if you spent $5 to get to $100, you could have brought her flowers 20 times through the course of a year. That's twice a month. Tony's getting the elbow in the side, I think, right now. He's listening, O'Sherry. He's listening. And by the way, Sherry, you're not even supposed to be listening to what I'm saying here. You're supposed to tune out. Guys, it's not the amount of money that you spend. It's taking the time that on the way home from the office, you think of her and you stop by the Kroger, because you saw in the ad, they've got tulips for $5.99. And you pick those up and you bring them home. But that's speaking her language. That's something she can understand. And what it says to her is that he cares. He thinks I'm special. He loves me. He's trying to speak my language. And the great thing about it is that God has built into our wives this. He's hardwired them with this responder nature that even the most feeble of efforts on your part are appreciated because it shows you're trying to speak her language. Dr. Willard Harley said, "A man can have the best intentions to meet his wife's needs, but if he thinks her needs are similar to his own, he will fail miserably because she speaks a different language." $5 a week, guys. $5 every couple weeks. Doesn't take much. All right, ladies, you can tune me back in now. Conversation. The only way you're going to know your wife is to speak with her, to communicate to her. From the very beginning, The Bible shows us in the book of Genesis that a woman is designed to relate and to connect and to respond. Men, we use conversations to convey solutions that bring conversations to an end. Women use conversations to expand their understanding of relationships. And that's why women tend to circle the airport in conversations and men tend to give the Reader's Digest condensed version of a conversation. If you put my wife on one plane going one way and me on a plane going another way, the things that happen on that plane are going to be very different. By the time my wife flies to Florida, she is going to know the entire life story of the person sitting next to her. When I'm going to California, I might say hi to the guy sitting next to me. Or maybe you're in my seat. That's just the difference of guys and girls. To a man, all of those details in a conversation, just they seem unrelated, they seem irrelevant. But to her, they're of vital importance. Because she doesn't have any, there's no big point in mind. She's not trying to get to a solution. There's no bottom line. For her, it's just about sharing her heart and her mind. And there's times where she doesn't want you to solve anything. She just wants you to listen. And there's times where Bev looks at me and she says, "Now, sweet, just understand. All I want you to do, I'm not looking for you to fix anything. I just want you to listen to me." I can get it when it's that clear. And I listen. Really knowing your wife involves knowing things about her that nobody else in the world knows. Her greatest fears, her greatest concerns, her disappointments, her expectations. And it's going to require you to be open and honest, to provide more to her than just some physical security, but an emotional security. To communicate in a number of different ways that she is the priority of your life. Gentlemen, here's a homework assignment for you. Before the end of the week, I want you at some point, and don't do it right now and say, "I've got my homework done either." At some point this week, I want you to look at your wife and I want you to say, "Sweetheart, outside of Jesus Christ, you are the most important person in my world." Can you do that? Catch her off guard. What do you do? Don't look at her and say, "Sweetie, I'm going to get my homework done, so could you have your attention here?" Now, we said that there's inferior substitutes, cheaper and easier ways. The substitute here is just to assume. That to think you know your wife, you take that to mean I really do know my wife. Peter's not just encouraging husbands to be informed of their wife's needs. He's commanding them to take steps to address those needs. Nobody likes to be misunderstood, husbands. And when we truly begin to understand our wives and communicate with her and get to know who she really is, it'll do as much for your marriage as anything that you could possibly do because it demonstrates love and concern for her. Now, you'll notice that Peter adds an element here, and he says that the reason for living with our wives, or at least part of it, is because it's with someone weaker since she is a woman. It's not a commentary on physical or emotional strength. It's talking about his treatment of her. And I used to use the illustration that, guys, she's an expensive, fragile vase. And therefore, you need to be very careful. But all I get is blank stares. And so I changed my illustration to this. Fellas, she is a fully restored 1966 Corvette convertible. She is not a rusted out 1986 pickup truck with mud flaps. You get your hands around that, can't you? Being a husband that we ought to be means that we're not demanding, we're not unfair. We understand we're in a partnership with a very different creature who by divine design requires our care and our protection, our love and our communication. Finally, Peter says at the end of verse 7 that we are to honor her as a fellow grace of life. It's our responsibility to assign her a place of value, to esteem her, to appreciate her. When was the last time that you spoke some kind of word of appreciation to her? You thanked her for what she does around the house, or what she does with the kids, or the kind of person that she is, or the kind of Christian that she has become. Do you recognize her importance, not just in the place of your home and your marriage, but as one of God's holy people? In your words and your actions, are you providing sufficient proof that she is of supreme significance and value to you? I've got a little question that I've got a tape to my monitor at the office. It's a very simple question. And the question is this: does she know today? Does she know today? And so when I go to work and I look at my monitor, I ask myself that question. Does she know today that I love her? Does she know how much I appreciate her? The substitute is easy, isn't it? We do it all the time. We just take her for granted. We just imagine she's always just going to be there. She may not. She may not. She's not always going to be there. One of you is going to go. And if it's her, then express it to her now. Tell her now. Now, can we reject everything we just talked about? 1 Peter chapter 3, absolutely. Can fellas ignore everything that we've discussed in verse 7? They can do that. But Peter says they don't escape the spiritual consequences of that. He says you may be able to articulate one of the most beautiful prayers in the congregation, but in reality that prayer may get no higher than the ceiling. He says at the end of the verse, so that your prayers will not be hindered. When our relationship with our wives is not what it ought to be, there is this disconnect with God as well. It affects our relationship with Him. Malachi makes that point, and we'll talk about that more on Wednesday night. Back in 1992, Time Magazine did a study, or their cover story. And the title of the story was this: Men and Women Are Born Different. Revolutionary. I mean, before 1992, we didn't know that. I'm glad they clued us into that. We knew that a long time ago, didn't we? You're not married 6 months before you figured that part out. But it's by divine design. God made us different. And He made us different because that's what's effective and challenging and fun. I don't want to be married to somebody like me. I want to be married to somebody different from me. And so rather than arguing about whose way of thinking is the right way of thinking, let's just understand it. It's not a matter of right or wrong. It's just a matter of different. And start enjoying the differences that God has built into us because they're there to enrich our lives. Therefore, we need to resist this temptation to blur what are in truth divinely ordained distinctions. And so tonight I ask you as we close, what bricks are you willing to employ? Are you going to look for some cheap substitute, some inferior product? Or are you going to pay the price and do whatever it takes to have the real thing? I hope you choose the latter. Take your songbooks out if you would turn to the hymn that Michael has selected. It'll be our song of encouragement this evening. Tonight, if you're not a child of God, we want to invite you to become one. To come to a God who loves you more than you could ever imagine, who did so much on your behalf. The plan of salvation before eternity, before the creation of the world, the way leading up to it, the information, the plan that He lays out for us so clearly in the Old Testament writings, the coming of His Son, God becoming man, so that we could be right with Him. Don't spurn that invitation. If you're not a child of God, tonight's the night. Just decide that right now. Tonight's the night for me to become a Christian. To leave this building with a hope of heaven, having my sins washed away, being in a right standing with the One who made me. That's hope, folks. That gives you something to hold on to. That there's something on the other side. If we can help you with that, you need to be baptized into Christ this evening. Maybe you need to rededicate yourself. Maybe you just need some prayers, some encouragement. Whatever you need, won't you come together and stand?